Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey guys, Dr. Santosh here, pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher.
And this week, I was kind of looking around for things to do, searching everywhere for a good topic. I looked in nooks. I was in crannies. I was on top of the fridge. I was under the sink where we keep all the poisons. And then, as I was continuing to wander around my house looking for medical inspiration, my eyes happened to fall on a cake-battered wall, and the medicine cabinet. Do you have
absolutely
a medicine cabinet in your house, Santosh?
You know what? We actually don't. So the layout of our house right now does not have one of the mirrors that opens up and has a medicine cabinet behind it. We have everything in drawers below the sink.
This week, let's take a dive into the medicine cabinet for those of you who grew up with one, and for those of you who are just kind of looking around being like, oh yeah, what happened to them? They went the way of telephone booths and quicksand, you know, something we heard about a lot and ended up not seeing all that often.
At all, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
If we go back to just one century ago, we don't even need the Wayback Machine for this. We can suffice with our memory. But around the early 1930s, 10,000 New York families were part of a study conducted by the Office of Commissioner Accounts on the status of their home medicine cabinets. And this report collected data about what kind of drugs, devices, and other healthcare products the average family kept on hand for first aid treatment. And it came to a troubling conclusion.
Okay.
Because what other conclusions are there on this show?
Well, on occasion, we have a lovely yet surprising conclusion.
Surprising often, troubling equally. The Office of Commissioner of Accounts discovered that the average home medicine cabinet, the first line of defense in the protection of the family, was shockingly ill-stocked, full of outdated medicines and drugs that could cause terrible side effects, and usually missing several items the report considered to be absolutely necessary. By the end of this episode, you will know what those items are and what we recommend you should keep on hand in your medicine cabinet or medicine under the sink or wherever you are keeping your medicine. Lonely kitchen drawer, perhaps.
This is what I absolutely love about these kind of survey studies. Right? Is you go into it, you know, just trying to learn what's going on, and you find some things that you could take some serious action on that will actually improve people's lives. That is so, so cool. Josh, think about like the NHANES survey that we do every few years, which is a survey of like national healthcare workers and that kind of a thing. And it really teaches us, you know, kind of what our habits are, how we're doing, and what's killing us, like heart disease and diabetes and those rates and everything. But it really helps us focus in terms of what can we do to help people. So I love when a simple survey of medicine cabinets can really make lives better. That's fantastic. Yeah.
So based on the response of these 10,000 people and the equally panicked counter response from the government, the Consumer Project of the U.S. Department of Labor commissioned a bulletin to educate families about proper home health care. And it starts with, and I love this because I know it's like 1930s, but this definitely reads to me in the old 1950s radio announcer style voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you want to do it?
Do I? The average medicine cabinet presents a formidable array of bottles, jars, and boxes in the local home pharmacopoeia. The crowded shelves may look like a miniature drugstore, but still may not have on them those remedies which are best or most frequently needed for first aid treatment in the home. Especially problematic is the fact that the contents of the average medicine cabinet are based on commonly held ideas about best healthcare practices that are not, in fact, based on sound medical facts of the time. This bulletin is meant to address the situation by providing families with a list of 16 necessary items, including drugs like pain relievers, burn applications, tools like hot water bottles and toothbrushes, and surgical devices like scissors and tweezers.
Thank you, Josh. We'll come back on the hour every hour.
Don't forget Alka-Seltzer. Pop, pop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Wait. This report's a little biased now.
Like, oh, you're right. I need to put in a proper 20th century medical ad. This medical bulletin brought to you by cocaine. Good for what ails ya. Give it to your kids, put it in your soda. Cocaine, is there anything it cannot solve?
That's what I'm talking about.
For all that we joke, and I use any excuse to talk in my 20th century announcer voice, The idea of treating medicine at home, or the idea of treating illness and disease at home, was once the main way that everybody treated, and then we moved treatment to healthcare facilities, and now It's starting to tilt back in some methods to the home. Prior to the 20th century, medicine chests, cupboards, shelves, all these things were pretty common, but they didn't resemble what we think of as the medicine cabinet in the bathroom today. And for that matter, why is it in the bathroom? Any guesses?
This is an odd one. It's kind of a head scratcher for me, right? Because where could it be? I guess it actually could be in the living room, where, you know, you keep medications where you need them, you know, if you need a fever reducer or if you need a first aid kit. You wouldn't want to put it in the kitchen, right? Because then it could accidentally get mixed with your cooking somehow, one way or the other. Or it could spoil because there's heat in there, which you don't want for medications. But yeah, the bathroom, I don't know. It's such a ritual right now to keep medications in the bathroom and to take your meds. Like, for instance, first thing in the morning when you wake up or before you go to sleep.
Well, from the moment I wake up, before you put on your makeup, I take a little pill for you. Forever and ever. Yeah. You're actually a little bit counterintuitive, Santosh, and you're showing your temporal bias because in fact, medicine did used to be kept in the kitchen, and there's a very good reason for that, if a slightly misogynistic one.
Okay.
For centuries, women were the primary providers of care for their family's health needs, and most of the medicinal products and tools that they used were stored in the logical place, given the material constraints that were involved. The majority of medicinal remedies were mixed at home, using domestic books, including remedies alongside recipes for meals and other household prescriptions. Right? You would make your own. You'd make your own pharmacy in the thing, and then maybe pick up a couple local herbs or flowers from the apothecary, as well as the grocer, so you could make a stew and a draught. Or a draft
thank you. Is what you're thinking.
That's what.
Okay. Okay. So, I mean, you know, kitchen chemistry, right? For cooking and baking. Yeah. I guess that flows very easily into kind of making medications from kind of component parts. So I'm guessing it's not just, you know, like the old school herbal stuff. This is also, for instance, if you need to, I don't know, compound the aspirin that you get from the pharmacy, you would have like a mortar and pestle in there. And you'd have the tools that you need to mix and all that kind of a thing and weigh and measure and all that. Oh, that makes a ton of sense, actually. So you wouldn't get the medication necessarily ready to use. You'd have to kind of make it up.
Interestingly, okay. And we covered this in a previous season's episode on architecture and medicine. But when you really started to see the medicine cabinet move to the bathroom is around the 50s, when we started becoming concerned both, one, with hygiene and standardization and sterility. This really was brought about by a change in the layperson, the average everyday modern man's understanding of science. You had to believe in a new idea in medicine around this turn of the century. Human bodies were standardized, and the same medicine would work equivalently on everyone. So you had to believe there's a shared normal body temperature, that deviations from the norm meant ill health, not just a simple, oh, well, you know, that's just my body. And as antibiotics started becoming more common, as a greater understanding of science and discoveries, the invention of vaccines, kind of the medical industrial revolution took place. Okay. People started realizing, oh, maybe we don't want to keep all the things we put into our bodies for illness in the same place as we keep the food. And it started shifting over to the bathroom. So there was a real interesting change with a greater public knowledge of science that shifted where we culturally started thinking about putting things. Now, why don't we go into some of the items that you would typically expect to find in a medicine cabinet? Just off the top of your head, what's one you can think of?
Current or oldie-timey?
Well, again, we just talked about the standardization of bodies. So leaving out cocaine, heroin, and arsenic, what things do you think might be seen then and now?
So now is pretty easy. I'm going to have a razor.
Sure.
You know, for shaving. You'll have toothbrush and toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
You may have something for hair care, creams and lotions, so for skin care.
Right, and right. Puts the lotion on its skin.
Right. And for pain and fever is going to be some of the most common stuff. So acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and your other very common remedies, whether or not they work. So cold and cough remedies like NyQuil. And I guess some people will keep Mucomist, so N-acetylcysteine and Dimetapp or Robitussin, you know, one of those medications, which I gotta say, just they don't do anything, but they're some of the most prized things. And likewise, you know, for cough or sore throat, probably some like Halls or one of the other candy type of menthol stuff that you can do. Menthol rub for your chest. So, you know, menthol camphor in something like petroleum jelly, probably just petroleum jelly. So Vaseline, something like that.
Don't forget your petroleum peanut butter.
Yeah. that's gross. That's all I got right now off the top of my head.
So a few things I would add, and how about allergy medication?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Especially here in Los Angeles, where we're always hacking and coughing.
Yeah. So depending on the time of year and where you live, you should definitely have some kind of eye drop or antihistamine, drowsy or non-drowsy, your choice.
Ooh, I forgot to put in there, band-aids
yeah.
If you get a cut. Okay.
Bandages and gloves. Antibacterial cream or ointment. So you did get that one. So minor skin infections. And there's a difference between a cream and an ointment. Creams are water soluble and you put them on after washing a wound with soap and water.
Got it.
Ointments are oil based and can be used when the wound could be exposed to water, meaning it can't be totally covered up or it's, you know, somewhere that the sun may not shine, but the water will definitely reach.
Got it. Oh, I completely forgot about those. Okay, so creams and lotions, which are antiseptics as well for wound care.
Yeah, so something to get those topical wounds, those scraped knees.
In oldie-timey, thinking about wound care, and you were telling me that moms were largely responsible for, you know, this kind of a thing, would they have, like, stitching supplies in their medicine cabinet to actually, like, throw their own stitches?
Yeah, so they, the old-timey one recommended a sewing kit or a sewing needle and thread for mending small tears, cuts, or bruises. Now, they were not encouraged to perform surgery.
Sure.
This is more for bandages or, you know, in an immediate event. So, yes.
Okay.
And again, I'm kind of jumping around between some things that would still be found in different. So instead of finding topical ointments or creams, you might find salves, liniments to be placed kind of in the more old-timey medicine chests.
Cabinet. You'll still find these. So when I go back over to India, there are a few of these which are, they come in the form of a petroleum jelly. But for instance, you'd put it on your forehead. So there's one called Tiger Balm, B-A-L-M, which you put on your forehead to help relieve a headache, for instance.
Decongestants. And again, this almost kind of comes up with allergy as well.
Okay.
Along with pain relievers. Now, when you're choosing a pain reliever for your medicine cabinet, be sure to evaluate the needs of your particular household. Some can be taken every 12 hours. Some can be taken every 4 hours. And it's a good idea to have at least two different kinds of painkillers on hand.
Yeah, so meaning pain relievers that have different forms of action.
I like to keep Tylenol or the generic brand acetaminophen just always, always in there. And Motrin, which has a different mechanism of action, can't always be used across the same kinds of injuries. So sometimes I'm going to want to choose a Tylenol. Sometimes I'm going to want to take a Motrin. Or an ibuprofen. Yeah, yeah. I don't even remember what the brand or generic is anymore.
So the brand name in this case would be Motrin. Advil's another famous one here in the States. And ibuprofen is going to be your generic, yeah.
And I think Excedrin is on there too, and that's like Tylenol with caffeine.
With caffeine, yes. So combination, really, really good for headaches, actually, to use caffeine in conjunction with acetaminophen.
An anti-diarrheal medication. Especially if you have young kids, elderly people, or pets.
Yeah.
One of those
super
three.
Super important. So the brand name that we're thinking about here, like Imodium, for instance, to slow your bowels. And always remember, all you brilliant people out there, do not use, okay, these anti-diarrheals, especially in children, when they're having acute gastroenteritis, a stomach flu, because you actually could prolong their disease or potentially make things worse.
Also, don't use it if you notice blood in your stool, really for any reason. Even if it's hemorrhoids, you could just benefit from waiting a little bit. And if it's due to an infectious cause or an actual GI bleed, the last thing you want is to contract and stop those muscles from moving.
Yeah, that's a bad idea. So essentially, there's actually a very narrow window where you can use the Imodium safely. So I don't know how much that should maybe be in the drawer or in the cabinet.
Most causes of diarrhea are not going to be sufficient to warrant a hospitalization. So I think it is good to just kind of have it available. Certainly if you're going to be traveling, your family likes to go camping, take road trips, some of these can make good bug out bag medications as well as medicine cabinet.
Gotcha.
Here's one that definitely was kept on hands back in the day and should be today. Some form of activated charcoal.
Oh, yes. So this one, you know, and we think about it nowadays with a lot of, complementary medicine, or some people take it nutritionally, activated charcoal.
It does nothing. Nothing for you nutritionally. I don't want to hear a single word about it clears the toxins. No, you guys. It's meant to, like, when you have your stomach pumped, not drinking a smoothie.
Yeah. It is specifically for those organic compounds that can be absorbed by activated charcoal. All right. So organic compounds are, you know, are going to be a ton of different types of medications and toxins. If you accidentally or on purpose ingest a certain amount, and you need to make sure that it doesn't get absorbed into the bloodstream from your enteric tract, then activated charcoal, actually in quite large amounts, Josh, are used. And then hopefully it soaks up, you know, the medication or whatever, you know, you need to soak up. And you can then, just like you said, pump the stomach, yes, to remove all that stuff out, bound to the charcoal. Or, you know, if it has to and it's gone down far enough down the enteric tract, you just poop it out. But yeah, it's not going to do anything for nutrition or like so-called general health.
Yeah. So, but I mean, especially with young children, parents should have something to induce vomiting in the case of an accidental ingested poison. Now, activated charcoal has been the recommendation for years and years and years. But back in the old timey days, the good old cocaine ghost days, they recommended syrup of ipecac, so named because that's the sound you make on taking it. Ipecac.
Yeah. I think, Josh, you and I, we learned of a few, like a handful of indications for syrup of ipecac in emergency situations with toxin or medication ingestion. And I believe at this point, it's all gone away. We no longer have a good indication for syrup of ipecac. Right now, inducing vomiting in children or adults, actually, there's almost no indication for it. So, you know, when you take those kind of things, yes, activated charcoal can help. And then it's off to the ER to see what can be done, because we found that inducing vomiting just tends to create more problems than
And there is no, even though, you know, we're saying you should have some kind of charcoal around, this is not a substitute for medical advice and professional help. If you notice a poisoning, immediately contact 911, local poison control. And then if professional help is not readily available, you can administer the activated charcoal, with the most common side effects being black stool, black tongue, and vomiting.
Yeah, it does not taste good.
It's not supposed to. It's not a petroleum peanut butter and jelly.
Stop saying that.
Okay, so that's some of the medications they recommend keeping around.
Stop
a fever
thinking about petroleum peanut butter. It's in my brain.
So those are the kind of base classes of medication, an anti-diarrheal.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A vomiting inducer or an antitoxin, fever relievers, pain relievers, allergy relievers. Those are kind of the general medication classes. Now, they also recommend keeping adhesive bandages.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Important to have on hand. Some people prefer to have just gauze pads with tape versus adhesive, and it needs to be larger than your simple box of Band-Aids. A thermometer. Digital these days, no longer a livestock thermometer. Yes.
No more alcohol or mercury with glass that can break off inside someone. And it should be a digital thermometer that can either be rectal for little babies, or if, you know, for other people who are perhaps disabled, where you can get a rectal temperature, axillary under the armpit, or sublingual under the tongue.
Now, sublingual
not
is
not all at the same time.
Now, sublingual is going to be no. That's a whole section of the internet that we do not visit. Now, sublingual is going to be your probably gold standard in this case. The rectal temperature will give you the closest to the core body temperature, and while it's the most accurate reading, and the under the armpit is the least accurate, under the tongue strikes just the right balance between not terribly invasive for being shoved in your body, but also far more accurate at getting a rough gauge of what your temperature is.
Yeah, that's really ideal.
If you cannot get it into your mouth and you do not want it up your behind, then under the arm in adults is an okay substitute. Although, truthfully, with the rising levels of obesity around the world, axillary temperatures really aren't recommended for anybody anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately, if you do have elevated body mass index and, you know, you're obese, you're going to actually have surface temperatures, especially in body folds, so like under the armpit, which can be quite off from your core temperature. So, Josh, you're right. For our kids who are actually, you know, as long as their ideal body weight and, you know, they don't have any of those kind of metabolic syndromes, which unfortunately we are now seeing at very young ages, then we do use those often. So, for instance, our infants and our toddlers are pretty good for axillary. But you're right, beyond that, it gets difficult to actually use that accurately as your core temperature.
Also, in pediatric households, a nasal aspirator bulb. Think of a reverse turkey baster for teeny noses.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different ones that you can have here. There is one where it's a bulb, so you squeeze the bulb, you put the tip in the nose, and you let go of the bulb. So as the bulb expands, it creates suction. But Josh, there is one so named, called a nose Frida, where you put a filter in the tube so that you don't suck up snot, but you put the little tip in the nostril and you use your breath to actually, you know, kind of suck out the snot there. I know it sounds gross, but there's a good filter and a nice long tube, so you're not putting your nose right up or mouth right up to your kid's nose, and it's very, very effective in getting out snot.
Tweezers are useful for removing splinters and also ticks.
Yes. And always remember with ticks, right? Grasp the body and you pull straight perpendicular to the skin. Make sure the head comes out.
Now, this is no longer recommended, but I think just because you don't want to keep these in a bathroom cabinet, a lighter or matches, basically a source for fire, which in the olden times would be used to, you know, quickly sterilize some of these instruments, which were then made of glass or metal. Less common now to have to sterilize a razor to perform battlefield bathroom surgery.
Yeah, that's...
But for emergency purposes, it's probably not a bad idea to at least have, you know, a hotel-sized matchbook thing. Do they still have those? Do hotels still give out matches?
I don't think so. I think too many fires have happened, so they'll give you a mint instead.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, the ability to have fresh breath, equally important with the ability to make fire in human advancement. Having at least some creatable source of flame is probably not a terrible idea.
It's not, yeah. It's a good idea.
So let's kind of circle back. One of the things that we as men did not mention is menstrual supplies.
How dare you, sir? Why must you bring up something so vulgar?
Yeah, so interestingly, menstrual supplies were usually kept not in the bathroom back in the day, but would be hidden away in the bedroom, usually under the bed, or in little, again, nooks and crannies, and only taken into the bathroom to be used. And there's this sense at the time that the bathroom was too public a space in which to keep these things. Over time, the under-the-sink cabinet came into use, rather than the medicine cabinet, as a space to keep menstrual supplies.
Right next to the, you know, harsh detergents and whatnot.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting, though, that when you think of all these things, like bandages, gauze, stuff to deal with bleeding, I'm like, wait a minute, why don't you ever see things like tampons or female hygienic supplies in a medicine cabinet? Why is it always under the sink? And that's why. It was purely cultural.
This is something that needs to break sometime soon. Yeah, it needs to be very, very widely available. You know, female hygiene and feminine supplies should be just as easy to get to as, you know, your Tylenol or your acetaminophen. It's so silly.
When we start looking at the medicine cabinet, let's look at the history of the cabinet. There was a 1941 contest in the pages of Popular Science. So remember, when I told you the cabinet started moving from the kitchen to the bathroom, 1941 contest in Popular Science asking readers to design a new medicine cabinet to respond to the needs of the increasingly modern home and the forms of patient labor that were emerging. And this was exciting because it brought the idea that when you're a person selecting an object from your medicine cabinet, you're not just a consumer, you know, you've chosen and bought that thing, but now you're a medical worker who's going to use that object on yourself. I think we've taken that idea a little too far in 2021.
Yeah. Yes, we have.
But back in the 50s, this was super exciting.
This is the new thing.
Or what were some of the elements of design in the first prize winner?
Is it the mirror in the front so that you had a use for it when it's open or closed?
Yeah, inner and outer mirrors, which have remained to this day, at least the outer mirror. Some of the things that have disappeared that I think would be neat to bring back, drug lock boxes to separate dangerous medications from more standard safe items like, you know, razors and Q-tips.
Oh, that's really smart. Okay, so it would, I'm guessing, have a little lock on it, so, you know, only the person who had the key.
Yeah, as well as his and hers drawers. Also, you can separate your little pill counts into like, oops, don't want to accidentally take the birth control pills as I'm trying to grow my hair back out. There's some really, really interesting kind of things. You don't really think of it as gendered technology, but growing up as a kid, who would use the thermometer on you?
Mom.
Right. So that's why all these things would be placed in areas that were convenient to usually mothers and women, except for their, again, the woman of the house is the person in charge of maintaining the space to standards of cleanliness, standards of what a healthy home was supposed to be like. And as women caretakers increasingly move not only from being in charge of the house, but becoming these medical workers selecting the family's medicines, where are they going in to clean cuts and bruises? Well, in the newly sterile bathrooms made of white tile, looking like labs, to perform in medical operating theaters. But again, this is not an exact line. It's not like every housewife in America and around the world thought, I'm a doctor, I better go to my operating bathroom. But as one room in the house increasingly becomes associated with sterility, you start keeping your healthcare items in that space.
Now, I will say, just in terms of, I guess, what they would call like traditional roles. So, you know, if mom was the one who was, you know, spending the most time taking care of kids, their ideas of, from the pediatric standpoint, you know, who had what conditions, who needed what medications, and then that kind of intuitive feel that you and I learned, Josh, that thing of like, oh, that person looks sick or doesn't quite look right. I fully, fully understand that practice kind of makes them superior. And in some ways, Josh, very interestingly, it actually makes them superior to physicians and nurses. So, you know, the whole like hand on the forehead trick to say, oh, do you have a fever, right? So it's not very accurate by any means, but moms, okay, who don't have any medical training are actually more accurate than physicians and nurses. It's actually been scientifically proven that they're right, I think some 60 something percent of the time, whereas physicians and nurses were like 40% of the time. Mm-hmm. So having all that kind of just experiential knowledge, it would make so much sense that this would be set up and ready to go, you know, for that particular role. Now, Josh, you got to help me out because something happened in the middle here where we had the beautiful sterile tiles. And then somehow, like in the 70s, we went to shag carpet on the toilet. What the hell? People did we just give up on health?
No, people did a lot of drugs in the 60s. But getting back to this idea of the medicine cabinet, so we've started moving into this, you know, making the bathroom a sterile space, and now you're moving into scientific motherhood, where instead of, oh, you know, my grandmother passed this down to my mother who passed it down to me, you've got, you know, again, the homemaker being told by experts in various fields, stock this, stock that, advertisers start getting in on the deal. You know, here's a mm-hmm. device to use in your home, and this is the space designed to house it. So okay. It's you're being bombarded from all sides with this concept of, you know, medicine cabinet, and that's why you start getting tropes in entertainment. In fact, how many times, at least in our lifetime, can you think of a sitcom where somebody goes snooping around the medicine cabinet to learn about the host?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a very, very common trope. And then if you want to punish that snooper, then while they're in there and the medicine cabinet falls off, like it's not properly attached, you crash, crash all over the
place. Yeah, so think about that. It's a medicine cabinet is a private space in a area with a bathroom, which is a public dimension. So, you know, you have this private space you're inviting guests into, and then they're actually breaking into your home while invited into your home.
All right. All right. Yeah. So it's meant to be, and hence probably some of the lock boxes and stuff in case a snooper or kids get in there that you don't want to get in. So, you know, used to have a spot that was actually locked up by a key. But okay, so this was supposed to be my particular area because looking in there tells you too much about what's actually going on in my personal life.
Right. So that's kind of it, you know, in terms of where the evolution of the medicine cabinet came in. Now, interestingly, I told you don't really see that anymore. It's gone the way of quicksand and the buffalo. And yeah. Part of that is because nowadays you really don't want to keep medicine in the bathroom. Now, some of the other supplies, yes, you know, things like bandages, Q-tips, razors, but you don't want to keep medicine because humidity can impact and in some cases completely inactivate some very sensitive type of medications. Now,
okay.
If you're keeping your Tylenol and your Benadryl and your Neosporin all in the bathroom, the amount of humidity, unless you're showering nonstop and live in, say, India, is probably not enough to really have a genuine effect. But modern theory of thinking and supply chains and storage is saying now you want to keep it in a cool, dry space and things are moving back to the kitchen.
Okay, yeah, all right. And that does make sense. So right now in my house, we actually have a taller cabinet, which is away from the cooking space, but it's still in the kitchen where we keep most of the drugs.
Now, the last thing I want to kind of touch on before we bring this episode to a close is, what do you do with those expired medications?
Yeah. And this
what is the Best Buy date? You know, right? It says, I have enough trouble with my groceries. Now I have to worry about my medications. What's going to happen when they expire?
And there is going to be some controversy here, right, Josh? Because we've actually found out from actually really cool studies that were done kind of unearthing medications from World War II and stuff like that and actually testing their chemical action and their viability that actually a lot of solid medication, so the ones that come in the form of pills and powder, they actually hold up a lot longer than we think. And a lot of the liquids too pretty much stay okay for quite a bit longer than it says on the, like, the expiry date. So a little bit of controversy here, but again, we don't want to go completely against what it says in the bottle.
So the U.S. Food and Drug Administration recommends never taking drugs beyond their date as it's risky with unknown variables. But since we know most of you ignore that, here is some safer data. Ongoing research shows that stored under optimal conditions, you know, like pasta, cool, dry place, drugs retain about 90% of their potency for up to 5 years after the labeled expiration date, and sometimes longer. Even at 10 years after the expiration date, you can retain up to about 60 to 70% effectiveness of the potency. Now, that does come with a few caveats, and I will link to that study. And it was the aim of the Shelf Life Extension Program undertaken by the Department of Defense, which found that 88% of 122 different drugs stored under ideal conditions could have their expiration dates extended more than a year, with an average of 66 months and a maximum of 278 months. Now, certain medications have a very narrow therapeutic window. In case you were wondering what those are, a couple examples, and I'm not going to give you an exhaustive list for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
Are insulin and nitroglycerin and sulfur-based medications, all of which can degrade and become toxic within that period after expiration.
Right.
So,
and you can tell what a lot of those are because it says right on the box, you know, keep refrigerated and away from light. So they're already delicate if they're brought up to room temperature or they're exposed to either natural or UV light.
You know, ones which I don't actually have is an EpiPen may have less effect, but it's still better than nothing in an emergency situation.
Right, right. Absolutely.
But most of the pills you have, yeah, if they've expired, the best thing you can do is put them off in a corner somewhere. And if you're not taking them to be disposed of, don't just flush them down the toilet. That creates antibiotic resistance.
And all sorts of other weird things as the water runoff affects our groundwater and wildlife. So absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't create Ninja Turtles. It creates super bacteria.
Yes.
Keep them around and really use for emergencies, but also keep a look at what's expired. And so that way you know what to restock. And expired medications, worst case scenario, can go into an emergency kit that you can grab if you're on your way out the door for a hurricane, a flood, or a zombie apocalypse.
Wait, sorry, did you say zombie?
I mean, you never know. We've already had one pandemic.
Thought we were trying to be semi-serious, but okay.
Right, semi. We gotta moderation in all things. But yeah, the expiration dates are very conservative to ensure you get the maximum efficacy of these. So just like with regular food where you're like, can I still have this after the expiration? The short answer is yes. The longer answer is yes, but it becomes much less effective with each successive year. And probably after 5 years, you should just toss it and have replaced it. So that's it for this week. As we have finished snooping around your medicine cabinet, I hope you have it all stocked up. Now, last parting shot. Do you know what the Q in Q-tip stands for?
Q, is it the little shape of the, get a little bump?
No, it's quality. They were ready-made cotton swabs invented in 1923 after the inventor Leo Gerstenzang noticed his wife making her own version by just wrapping cotton around toothpicks. Oh,
oh dear. And yeah, okay, okay. But and to this day, as it says on the box, and as we all recommend as physicians and caretakers, you really shouldn't be using those in your external auditory canal. You can clean around the outside of your ear, or use it for a couple of other applications, but don't stick them in your body.
Just remember, folks, the Q is for quality.
Quality tips. Okay, as opposed to not so quality tips, just like a tuft of
toothpick. As opposed to cotton around a toothpick. Yeah. So that's it for this week. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. And until next time, as always, wash your hands, wear a mask, restock your medicine cabinet, get your shot, find a country that is still open when you've done all those things, and after that, happy travels.
Happy travels, everybody.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.